valves and finally found one. He turned it. Hard to do with a valve that old. He was afraid his great strength would just twist the top off. From the nearby garage, he got some penetrating oil and went back and worked the valve over. Finally, he got it open. Nothing happened. Turl traced the old water system to a tank the Chinkos had built. He shook his head over the crudity of it. It had a pump, but the charge cartridge was long expended. He freed up the pump and put a new cartridge in it. Intergalactic was never one for innovations, thank the stars. The cartridges the pump needed were the same ones still in use. He got the pump whirring, but no water came. Finally, he found the pond. The old pipe was simply not in the water, so with one stamp of his boot, he put it back in. Up at the tank, the water began to run in, and down in the cage, the pool began to fill swiftly. Turl grinned to himself. A mining man could always handle fluids, and here, too, he hadn't lost his touch. He went back into the cage. The big center pool was filling rapidly. It was muddy and swirling since it had been full of sand, but it was wet water. The pool filled up to the top and slopped over, spilling across the floor of the cage. The man-thing was hastily picking up its things and jamming them into the bars to escape the inundation. Turl went back outside and shut off the valve. He let the tank on the hill fill and then shut that off. The cage was practically awash, but the water was draining off through the bars. Good enough. Turl slopped over to the man-thing. It was clinging to the bars to keep out of the water. It had the hides way up, jammed over the cross braces. To keep them dry? It was holding on to the books with one hand. Turl looked around. Everything was in order now, so he had better look into these books. He started to take them out of its hand, but it held on. With some impatience, Turl smashed at its wrist and caught the two books as they fell. They were man books. Puzzled, Turl leafed through them. Now where could this thing have picked up man books? He drew his eye bones together, thinking. Ah, the Chinko guidebook. There had been a library in that town. Well, maybe this animal had lived in that town. But books? This was better and better. Maybe, like the Chinkos had said, these animals could grasp meaning. Turl could not read the man characters, but they obviously were readable. This first one here must be a child's primer. The other one was some kind of child's story. Beginner books. The animal was looking stoically away in another direction. It was useless, of course, to try to talk to it. Turl halted his thought in mid-blink. Better and better for his plans. It had been talking. He remembered now. What he had thought were growls and squawks like you get from any animal had been reminiscent of words. And here were books. He made the thing look at him by turning its head. Turl pointed to the book and then at the thing's head. It gave no sign of understanding. Turl pushed the book up close to its face and pointed at its mouth. No sign of recognition occurred in the eyes. It either wasn't going to read or it couldn't read. He experimented some more. If these things could actually talk and read, then his plans were sure winners. He turned the pages in front of its face. No sign of recognition. But it had books in its possession. It had books, but it couldn't read. Maybe it had them for the pictures. Ah, success. Turl showed it a picture of a bee, and there was a flicker of interest and recognition. He showed it the picture of the fox and again that flick of recognition. He took the other book with pages of solid print. No sign of recognition. Got it. He put the small books in his breast pocket. Turl knew what to do. He knew every piece of everything in the old Chinko quarters, and that included man language discs. They had never written up what man ate, but they had gone to enormous trouble with man language. Typically Chinko. Miss the essentials and soar off into the stratosphere. He knew tomorrow's program. Better and better. Turl checked the collar, checked the rope, securely locked up the cage, and left. 6. It had been a damp, cold, thoroughly miserable night. Johnny had clung to the bars for hours, loath to sit down or even step down. Mud was everywhere. The gush of water had taken the sand and dirt in the pool and spread it all over the cage, and the dirt of the floor had avidly soaked it up. The mud became ankle-deep. But at last, exhausted, he had given in and slept lying in the mud. Mid-morning sun was drying it somewhat. The two dead rats had floated away out of reach, and Johnny didn't care. Already dehydrated from his previous experience, he felt the hot sun increase his thirst. He looked at the muddy pool, contaminated with slime from the cage. He could not bring himself to drink it. He was sitting miserably against the bars when the monster appeared. It stopped outside the door and looked in. It was carrying some metallic object in its paws. It looked at the mud, and for the moment Johnny thought it might realize he couldn't go on sitting and sleeping in the mud. It went away. Just as Johnny believed it would not come back, it reappeared. This time it was still carrying the metal object, but it was also carrying a huge rickety table and an enormous chair. The thing made tricky work getting through the door with all that load, a door too small for it in the first place. But it came on in and put the table down. Then it put the metal object on the table. Johnny had at first believed that the huge chair was for him, but he was quickly disabused. The monster put the chair down at the side of the table and sat down on it. The legs of it sunk perilously into the mud. It indicated the mysterious object. Then it took the two books out of its pocket and threw them on the table. Johnny reached for them. He had not thought he would ever see them again, and he had begun to make out of them a kind of sense. The monster cuffed his hands and pointed at the object. It waved a paw across the top of the books in a kind of negative motion and pointed again at the object. There was a sack on the back of the object, and it had discs in it about the diameter of two hands. The monster took out one of the discs and looked at it. It had a hole in the middle with squiggles around it. The monster put the disc on top of the machine. There was a rod there that fitted into the middle of the disc. Johnny was extremely suspicious, his hand bruised from the cuff. Anything this monster was up to would be devious, treacherous, and dangerous. That had been adequately proved. The game was to bide one's time, watch, and learn, and out of that possibly wrest freedom. The monster now pointed to two windows on the front of the object. Then it pointed to a single lever that stuck out from the front of it. The monster pushed the lever down. Johnny's eyes went round. He backed up. The object talked. Clear as a bell, it had said, "Excuse me." The monster pulled the lever up and it stopped talking. Johnny drew back further. The monster clouted him between the shoulder blades and drove him up to the table so hard the edge hit his throat. The monster raised a cautionary finger at him. It shoved the lever up, and by standing on tiptoe, Johnny could see that the disc went backward from the way it had gone. The monster pulled the lever down again. The object said, "Excuse me, but I am..." The monster centered the lever and the machine stopped. Then it pushed the lever up and the machine went backward again. Johnny tried to look under the machine and back of it. The thing wasn't alive, surely. It didn't have ears or a nose or a mouth. Yes, it did have a mouth. A circle low down in front of it. But the mouth didn't move, sound just came out of it. And it was talking Johnny's language. The monster pushed the lever down again, and the object said, "Excuse me, but I am your..." This time Johnny saw that some odd squiggles had been showing up in the top window, and a strange face in the lower window. Once more the monster pushed the lever up, and the disc on top went backward. Then the monster centered the lever. It pointed a talon at Johnny's head, and then at the object. Johnny noticed then that the monster had been moving the lever off-center, all positions to the left. The monster now moved the lever all the way over, to the right and down, and different squiggles appeared, but the same picture showed, and the machine said something in some strange tongue. The monster backed it up and put the lever in the left, right, center, and down. Different squiggles, same lower picture, but an entirely different set of sounds. Behind the face mask, the monster seemed to smile. It repeated the last maneuver again and pointed to itself. Johnny suddenly understood that that was the monster's language. Johnny's interest was immediate, intense, and flaming. He reached up and pushed the monster's paw away. It was hard to reach because the table was so high and big, but Johnny made nothing of that. He moved the lever up and to the left. Then he moved it down. The machine said, "Excuse me, but I am your instructor." Then Johnny did the same operation in the right-hand position, and it said something that was language, but strange. Then he did it in the center position, and it spoke again in the language of the cyclos. The monster was looking at him closely, even suspiciously. It bent way over and peered back into Johnny's face. The flickering amber eyes slitted. Then it made a doubtful motion toward the machine, as though it would pick it up and carry it off. Johnny slapped the huge hands away and fastened again on the lever. He put it in the left track and let it roll. "Excuse me," the machine said, "but I am your instructor, if you will forgive such arrogance. I do not have the honor to be a cyclo. I am but a lowly chinko." The face in the bottom window bowed twice and put a hand over its eyes. "I am Joga Stenko, junior assistant language slave in the language division of the Department of Culture and Ethnology, Planet Earth." Squiggles were running rapidly in the upper window. "Forgive my presumption, but this is a course of study in reading and speaking the man languages of English and Swedish. On the left-hand track of the record, I hope you will have no trouble in finding English. On the right-hand track, you will find the same text in Swedish. On the center track, the same text is in Cyclo, the noble language of conquerors. The written equivalent in each case appears in the upper window, and suitable pictures appear in the lower window. You will pardon my humble pretensions of learnedness. All wisdom abides in the governors of Cyclo, and one of their major companies, the great and mighty Intergalactic Mining Company, on which let there be profit." Johnny centered the lever. He was breathing hard. The language was stilted, oddly pronounced, and many of the words he did not know, but he grasped it. He looked more closely at the object. He frowned, concentrating heavily. And then he grasped that it was a machine, a not-live thing. That meant that the insect had been not live either. Johnny looked at the monster. Why was this thing doing this? What fresh dangers and privations did it have in mind? There was no kindness in those amber eyes. They were like a wolf's eyes seen in firelight. The monster pointed toward the machine, and Johnny pulled the lever down to the left. "Excuse me," it said, "but we will begin with the necessary alphabet. The first letter is A. Look at the upper window." Johnny did and saw the marks. "A is pronounced A. Its sound is also A as in pat, A as in pay, A as in care, A as in father. Look at it well, excuse me, please, so you can always recognize it. The next letter of the alphabet is B. Look at the window. It always has the sound of B, as in bat." The monster batted his hand up and opened the primer to the first page. It tapped a talon on A. Johnny had already made the connection. Language could be written and read. And this machine was going to teach him how to do it. He centered the lever and pulled it down, and there it was evidently spouting an alphabet in cyclo. The little face in the lower window was showing mouth formations to say the sounds. He swung the lever over to the right, and it was saying an alphabet in Swedish? The monster stood up, looking the 4 feet down to Johnny. It took 2 dead rats from its pocket and dangled them in front of Johnny. What was this? A reward? It made Johnny feel like a dog being trained. He didn't take them. The monster made a sort of shrugging motion and said something. Johnny couldn't understand the words. But when the monster reached over to pick up the machine, he knew what they must have been. Something like, "Lesson's over for the day." Johnny instantly pushed the arms away from the machine. He moved over defiantly and stood there, blocking the reach. He wasn't sure what would happen, if he'd be batted halfway across the cage. But he stood there. So did the monster, head on one side, then the other. The monster roared. Johnny didn't flinch. The monster roared some more, and Johnny divined, with relief, that it was laughing. The monster's belt buckle, showing the clouds of smoke in the sky, was a few inches below Johnny's eyes. It connected with the ancient legend that told of the end of Johnny's race. The laughter beat at Johnny's ears, a growling thunder of mockery. The monster turned around and went out, still laughing as it locked the gate. There was bitterness and determination on Johnny's face. He had to know more, much more. Then he could act. The machine was still on the table. Johnny reached for the lever. 7. The summer heat dried out the mud. White clouds spotted the skies above the cage. But Johnny had no time for them. His whole concentration was on the teaching machine. He had gotten the huge chair shifted around, and by lifting the seat height with folded skins, he could hunch over the table close, facing the old Chinko, who, in the picture, fawned in an agony of politeness as he taught. Mastering the alphabet in English was quite a trick, but mastering it in Cyclo was even worse. Far, far easier to trail game by its signs and know, almost to the minute, how long ago it had passed and what it was doing. These signs and symbols were fixed deathless on a screen, and the meanings that they gave were unbelievably complex. In a week, he thought he had it. He had begun to hope. He had even commenced to believe that it was easy.
B is for bats, Z is for zoo, H is for hats, and Y is for you.
And by going over the same text in Cyclo, the bats, zoos, hats, and yous became, a little incomprehensibly, pens, shovels, kerbango, and females. But when he finally grasped, under the Chinko's governing tutelage, that Cyclo words for hats, zoos, and bats would start with different letters, he knew he had it. He at length could lie back and rattle off the alphabet in English. Then he could, with a bit of squinting, sit up and rattle off the Cyclo alphabet in Cyclo, and with all the different nuances of how they sounded. Johnny knew he mustn't take too long at this. The diet of raw meat would eventually do him in. He was close to semi-starvation since he could barely bring himself to eat it. The monster would come and watch him a little while each day. While he was there, Johnny was silent. He knew he must sound funny while he drilled, and the monster's laughter made the back of his hair stand up. So he would be very quiet under that scrutiny from outside the cage. It was a mistake. The monster's eye bones behind the breathe mask plate were coming closer and closer together with a growing frown. The triumph of the alphabet was short-lived. At the end of it, the monster, one beautiful bright day, yanked open the door of the cage and came roaring in like a storm. It yelled at Johnny for minutes on end, the cage bars shaking. Johnny expected a cuff, but he didn't cringe when the monster's paw snaked out. But it was reaching for the machine, not Johnny. It yanked the lever down into a second stage that Johnny had never suspected. A whole new set of pictures and sounds leaped out. The old Chinko said in English,
"I am sorry, honored student, and forgive my arrogance, but we will now begin the drill of progressive cross-association of objects, symbols, and words."
And there was a new sequence of pictures. The sound for H, the picture of H, began to follow one another at a slow interval. Then the cyclo letter that had an H-like sound began to repeat in sound and picture. and then they went faster and faster until they were an almost indistinguishable blur. Johnny was so astonished he did not realize the monster had left. Here was a new thing. The lever was so big and resistive, he had not realized that all this lurked just beyond another thrust of pressure. Well, if a little push down would do that, what happened with a little push up? He tried it. It almost blew his head off. It took him quite a space of travel of the sun-made bar shadows to get brave enough to try it again. Same thing. It almost knocked him off the chair. Holding back, he stared at the thing suspiciously. What was it that came out of it? Sunlight? He tried it again and let it hit his hand. Warm, tingling. Carefully staying off to the side, he saw that pictures were appearing in the frames. And he heard, in the weirdest way, sort of with his head, not his ears, "Beneath the level of your consciousness, the alphabet will now go in. A, B, C." What was this? Was he hearing through his hand? No, that couldn't be. He wasn't hearing at all, except for that meadowlark. Soundless somethings were coming from the machine. He moved a little further back. The impression was less. He moved closer. He felt that his brains were frying. "Now we will do the same sounds in cyclo." Johnny went over to the furthest extension of his chain and sat down against the wall. He thought and thought about it. He grasped at last that the cross-association drill of symbols, sounds, and words was to get him very fast, and then faster and faster, so he did not have to grope for what he had been taught, but would be able to use it without hesitation. But this shaft of sunlight coming out of the machine. He got braver. He went back and found a disc that must be very advanced, and put it on. Bracing himself, he grimly pushed the lever all the way up. Suddenly, he knew that if all three sides of a triangle were equal, all its enclosed three angles were also equal. He backed up. Never mind what a triangle was or an angle, he now knew. He went back and sat down against the wall. Suddenly, he reached out with his finger and drew in the dust a three-pointed shape. He poked a finger at each inside bend. He said, wonderingly, "They're equal." "Equal what?" "Equal each other." "So what?" Maybe it was valuable. Johnny gazed at the machine. It could teach him in the ordinary way. It could teach him by speeding the lesson up. And it could teach him very smoothly and instantly with a beam of sunlight. Abruptly, an unholy joy began to light his face. Alphabet? He had to learn the whole civilization of the cyclos. Did that monster realize why he wanted it? Life became a long parade of discs, stacks of discs. Every hour not needed for sleep was spent at the table, with straight picture learning, with progressively speeding cross-association, with the piercing beams of sunlight. Half-starved, his sleep was restless. Nightmares of dead cyclos were intertwined with raw rats chasing mechanical horses that flew, and the discs went round and round. But Johnny kept on cramming years of education into weeks and months. There was so much to know. He had to grasp it all. And with only one goal in mind, vengeance for the destruction of his race, could he learn enough, fast enough, to accomplish his purpose? 8. Turl had felt smug right up to the moment he received the summons from the planetary director. He was nervous now, waiting for the appointment to occur. The weeks had fled on, the summer fading into the chill of autumn. The man-animal was doing well. Its every waking moment seemed to be spent crowded up against the Chinko language and technical instruction machine. It hadn't begun to talk yet, but of course it was just an animal and stupid. It hadn't even grasped the principle of progressive speed cross-association until it had been shown. And it didn't even have enough sense to stand squarely in front of the instantaneous conceptual knowledge transmitter. Didn't it realize you had to get the full wave impulse to get it through your skull bones? Stupid. It would take months at this rate to get an education. But what could you expect of an animal that lived on a raw rat? Still, sometimes when he went in the cage, Turl had looked into those strange blue eyes and had seen danger. No matter. Turl had decided that if the animal proved dangerous, he could simply use it to get things started, and then at the first sign it was getting out of hand, it could be vaporized fast enough. One button push on a hand blaster. Zip, bang, no man animal. Very easily handled. Yes, things had been going very well until this summons. Such things made one nervous. There was no telling what the planetary director might have found out, no telling what tales some employee might have carried to him. A security chief was ordinarily not much consulted. In fact, by a devious chain of command, a security chief was not directly under the planetary director on all points. This made Turl feel better. In fact, there had been cases where a security chief had removed a planetary director, cases involving corruption. But still, the planetary director remained the administrative head and was the one who filed reports, reports that could transfer one or continue one on post. The summons had come late the night before, and Turl had not slept very well. He had tumbled around in his bed, imagining conversations. At one time, he had actually gotten up and combed through his office files, wondering what he had on the planetary director just in case. That he couldn't recall or find anything depressed him. Turl only felt operational when he had big leverage in terms of potential blackmail. It was almost with relief that he saw the appointment time arrive, and he rumbled into the office of the top cyclo. Numph, planetary director of Earth, was old. Rumor had it that he was a discard from the central company directorate. Not for corruption, but just for bumbling incompetence. And he had been sent as far away as they could send him. An unimportant post, a rim star in a remote galaxy, a perfect place to send someone and forget him. Numph was sitting at his upholstered desk, looking out through the pressure dome at the distant transshipment center. He was gnawing absently on a corner of a file folder. Turl approached watchfully. Numph's executive uniform was neat. His fur, turning blue, was impeccably combed and in place. He didn't look particularly upset, though his amber eyes were introverted. Numph didn't look up.
"Sit down," he said absently. "I come in response to your summons, your planet ship."
The old cyclo turned to his desk. He looked wearily at Turl.
"That's obvious."
He didn't much care for Turl, but he didn't dislike him either. It was the same with all these executives. Definitely not first team. Not like the old days, other planets, other posts, better staffs.
"We're not showing a profit," said Numph.
He threw the folder down on his desk. Two Kerbango saucepans rattled, but he did not offer any.
"I should imagine this planet is getting mined out," said Turl.
"That's not it. There's plenty of deep down ore to keep us going for centuries. Besides, that's the concern of the engineers, not security."
Turl didn't care to feel rebuked.
"I've heard that there's an economic depression in a lot of the company's markets, that prices are down."
"That could be, but that's the concern of the economics department at the home office, not security."
This second rebuke made Turl a bit restless. His chair groaned alarmingly under his bulk. Numph pulled the folder to him and fiddled with it. Then he looked wearily at Turl.
"It's costs," said Numph.
"Costs," said Turl, getting his own back a bit, "has to do with accounting, not security."
Numph looked at him for several seconds. He couldn't make up his mind whether Turl was being insolent. He decided to ignore it. He threw the folder back down.
"Mutiny is," said Numph.
Turl stiffened.
"Where's the mutiny?"
Not the slightest rumor of it had reached him. What was going on here? Did Numph have his own intelligence system that bypassed Turl?
It hasn't occurred yet, said Numpf. But when I announce the pay cuts and drop all bonuses, there's liable to be one.
Turl shuddered and leaned forward. This affected him in more ways than one. Numpf tossed the folder at him.
Personnel costs. We have 3,719 employees on this planet, scattered over 5 active mine sites and 3 exploratory sites. That includes landing field personnel, freighter crews, and the transshipment force. At an average pay of 30,000 galactic credits a year, that's 111,570,000 credits. Food, quarters, and breathe gas is averaged at 15,000 credits each. Comes to 55,785,000 credits. The total is 167,355,000 credits. Add to that the bonuses and transport, and we have nearly exceeded the value of our output. That doesn't count wear and tear, and it doesn't count expansion.
Turl had been dimly aware of this, and in fact, had used it as an argument, a false one, in furthering his own personal plan. He did not think the time was ripe to spring his project. But he had not anticipated that the powerful and rich intergalactic company would go so far as to cut pay and wipe out bonuses. While this affected him directly, he was far more interested in his own plan of personal wealth and power. Was it time to open up a new phase in his own scheme? The animal was actually doing pretty well. It probably could be trained for the elementary digging venture. It could be used to recruit other animals. He was pretty well convinced it could do the necessary mining, dangerous though it was. Stripping that vein out of the blizzard-torn sheer cliff would be quite a trick and might be fatal to some of the animals involved. But who cared about that? Besides, the moment the stuff was gotten out, the animals would have to be vaporized, so the secret could never leak.
We could increase our output, said Turl, fencing in toward his target. No, 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 said Numpf. That's pretty impossible.
He sighed.
We're limited on personnel.
That was cream to Turl's earbones.
You're right, said Turl, heading Numpf further into the trap. Unless we solve it, it will lead straight into mutiny.
Numpf nodded glumly.
In a mutiny, said Turl, the first ones the workers vaporize are the executives.
Again, Numpf nodded, but this time there was a flicker of fear in the depths of his amber eyes.
I'm working on it, said Turl.
It was premature, and he hadn't intended to spring it, but the time was now.
If we could give them hope that the cuts weren't permanent, and if we imported no new personnel, the threat of mutiny would be reduced.
True, true, said Numpf. We are already not bringing in any additional or new personnel. But at the same time, our installations are working very hard, and there's already some grumbling.
Agreed, said Turl.
He plunged.
But what would you say if I told you that right this minute, I was working on a project to halve our workforce within 2 years?
I'd say it would be a miracle.
That was what Turl liked to hear. Plaudits from one and all in the home office would be his yet. Numpf was looking almost eager.
No cyclo, said Turl, likes this planet. We can't go outside without wearing masks.
Which increases costs in breathe gas, said Numpf.
And what we need is a workforce of air breathers that can do elementary machine operation.
Numpf sank back, doubt hitting him.
If you're thinking of, what was their name? Chinkos. They were all wiped out ages back.
Not Chinkos, and I congratulate your planet ship on his knowledge of company history. Not Chinkos. There is a potential local supply.
Where?
I'm not going to say any more about it right now, but I want to report that I'm making progress and that it is very hopeful.
Who are these people?
Well, actually, they are not people, as you would say, but there are sentient beings on this planet.
They think? They talk?
They are very manually adept.
Numph pondered this.
They talk? You can communicate with them?
Yes, said Turo, biting off a bit more than he really knew.
They talk. There's a bird down on the lower continent can talk. A mine director there sent one. It could swear in cyclo. Somebody didn't replace the air cartridge in its dome and it died.
He frowned.
But a bird isn't manually...
No, 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 said Turo, cutting off the bumbling. These are little short things, two arms, two legs.
Monkeys? Turo, you can't be serious.
No, not monkeys. Monkeys could never operate a machine. I am talking about man.
Numph looked at him for several seconds. Then he said,
But there are only a few of them left, even if they could do what you say.
True, true, said Turo. They have been listed as an endangered species.
A what?
A species that is about to become extinct.
But a few like that would not resolve our...
Your planet ship, I will be frank. I have not counted how many there are left.
But nobody has even seen one for ages. Turl.
The recon drones have noted them. There were 34 right up in those mountains you see there. And they exist on other continents in greater numbers. I have reason to believe that if I were given facilities, I could round up several thousand.
Ah, well, facilities, expense.
No, no. No real expense. I have been engaged on an economy program. I have even reduced the number of recon drones. They breed fast if given a chance.
But if nobody has even seen one, what functions could they replace?
Exterior machine operators. Over 75% of our personnel is tied up in just that. Tractors, loading rigs... It's not skilled operation.
Oh, I don't know, Turo. If nobody has even seen one...
I have one.
What?
Right here. In the zoo cages near the compound. I went out and captured one. Took a bit of doing, but I made it. I was rated high in marksmanship at the school, you know.
Numph puzzled over it.
Yes... I did hear some rumor there was a strange animal out in the zoo, as you call it. Somebody, one of the mine directors, I think. Yes, Char it was, laughing about it.
It's no laughing matter if it affects pay and profits,
glowered Turl.
True, very true. Char always was a fool. So you have an animal under testing that could replace personnel. Well, well, remarkable.
Now, said Turl, if you will give me a blanket requisition on transport.
Oh, well, is there any chance of seeing this animal? You know, to see what it could do. The death benefits we have to pay on equipment accidents would themselves tip the profit loss scale if they didn't exist, or were minimized. There's also machine damage potential. Yes, the Home Office doesn't like machine damage.
I've only had it a few weeks, and it will take a little time to train it on a machine. But, yes, I think I could arrange for you to see what it could do.
Fine. Just get it ready and let me know. You say you're training it? You know it is illegal to teach an inferior race metallurgy or battle tactics. You aren't doing that, are you?
No, no, no. Just machine operation. The push-pull of buttons and levers is all. Have to teach it to talk to be able to give it orders.
I'll arrange for a demonstration when it's ready. Now, if you could just give me a blanket requisition.
When I've seen the test, there will be time enough, said Numpf.
Turl had risen out of his chair, the prepared sheets of requisitions half out of his pocket. He put them back. He'd have to think of some other way, but he was good at that. The meeting had come off pretty well. He was not feeling too bad. And then Numpf dropped the mine bucket on him.
Turl, said Numpf, I certainly appreciate this backup. Just the other day there was a dispatch from Home Office about your continued tour of duty here. They plan in advance, you know. But in this case they needed a security chief with field experience on home planet. I'm thankful I turned it down. I recommended you for another 10-year tour of duty.
I had only 2 years left to run, gagged Turl.
I know, but good security chiefs are valuable. It will do your record no harm to show you are in demand.
Turl made it to the door. Standing in the passageway, he felt horribly ill. He had trapped himself right here on this cursed planet. The glittering vein of gold lay in the mountains. His plans were going well in all other ways. It would take perhaps 2 years to get those forbidden riches, and the end of this duty tour would have been a personal triumph. Even the man thing was shaping up. Everything had been running so well. And now, 10 years more. Diseased crap. He couldn't stand that. Leverage. He had to have leverage on Numpf. Big leverage. 9. The explosion had been sharp and loud, completely unlike the dull roar that every 5 days regularly shook the cage and compound. With some skill and agility, Johnny had found that he could go up the bars using a cage corner and, bracing himself there, look far and wide across the plains to the mountains and down on the domed compound of the cyclos. Feet braced against the crossbars, he could almost relax in this precarious position. Winter had come. The mountains for some time now had been white. But today they were invisible under white-gray skies. To the east of the compound there lay a curious, huge platform. It was surrounded by widely spaced poles and wires. It had a flooring that was bright and shiny, some sort of metal. At its southern edge, there was a domed structure from which cyclos came and went. At the northern side of it was a different kind of field, a field where strange cylindrical craft arrived and departed. The craft would land with a cloud of dust. Their sides would open and rock and chunks of things would spill out, and the vessel would rise again into the air and fly away, dwindling to nothingness beyond the horizon. The dumped material would be pushed onto a belt that ran between towers, carrying the load over to the huge area of bright and shiny flooring. Through the days, craft after craft would come, and by the fifth day, there would be an enormous pile of material mounted up on the platform. It was then that the most mysterious thing would occur. At exactly the same time of the day, exactly every fifth day, there would be a humming. The material on the platform would glow briefly. Then there would be a roar, like a low thunderclap, and the material would vanish. It was this one feature of all the mysteries that surrounded him on his post at the top of the bars that riveted his attention. Where did it go? There it would be, a small mountain of material. And then, hum, roar, bang, it would be gone. Nothing ever reappeared on that shiny platform. The material was brought in by those flying objects, taken over by the belt, and there it vanished. Johnny had seen it happen often enough now that he could predict the minute, hour, and day. He knew the dome to the south would light up, the wires around the platform would vibrate and hum, and then, roar, bang, the piled material would be gone. But that wasn't what had happened down there today. One of the machines that pushed the material onto the belt had blown up. A swarm of cyclos were down there around it now. They were doing something with the driver, and a couple more were putting out a fire on the machine itself. The machines had big blades in front and were covered with a transparent dome where the driver sat. But the dome was off that one now, apparently blown off. A squat vehicle came up. The driver had been stretched out on the ground. They now put the body in a basket and put it into the squat vehicle, which was driven away. Another machine with a blade came over and pushed the damaged vehicle off to one side out of the way, and then went back to pushing material onto the belt. The cyclos went back to their machines and the dome. An accident of some sort, thought Johnny. He hung there for a while, but nothing else was going on. Yes, there was. His cage bars were trembling. But this was near to hand and ordinary. It was footsteps of the cyclo who kept him caged. Johnny slid down to the floor. The monster came to the door and unfastened it and entered. He glared at Johnny. The monster was quite unpredictable of late. He seemed calm one time and ruffled and impatient the next. Right now he was very impatient. He made a savage gesture at Johnny and then at the language machine. Johnny took a deep breath. Every waking hour for months he had been at that machine, working, working, working. But he had never spoken a word to the monster. He did so now. In cyclo, Johnny said, "Broke." The monster looked at him curiously. Then it went over to the machine and pushed down the lever. It didn't work. The monster shot a glare at Johnny as though Johnny had broken it, and then picked the machine up and looked under it. That was quite a feat in Johnny's eyes, for he himself couldn't budge it an inch on the table. The machine had just quit that morning, shortly before the explosion. Johnny moved closer to see what the monster was doing. It removed a small plate in the bottom, and a little button dropped out. The monster read some numbers on the button, and then laid the machine on its side and left the cage. He came back shortly with another button, put it in the same place, and put the plate back on. He righted the machine and touched the lever. The disc turned, and the machine said, "Forgive me, but addition and subtraction," and the monster put it in neutral. The monster pointed a talon at Johnny, and then urgently back at the machine. Johnny plunged again. In cyclo, he said, "Know all those. Need new records." The monster looked at the thick original sheaf of recordings, hundreds of hours of them. It looked at Johnny. Its face was grim, back of its face mask. Johnny was not sure he wasn't going to get knocked halfway across the cage. Then the monster seemed to make up its mind. It yanked the pack of discs out of the back of the machine and left. Shortly it returned with a new, thicker stack of discs and shoved them into the storage compartment of the machine. It took the old disc off and put the next sequentially numbered one on. Then it pointed at Johnny and back at the machine. Plainly, Johnny was supposed to get to work, and get to work now. Johnny took a deep breath. In cyclo, he said, "Man does not live on raw rat meat and dirty water." The monster just stood there staring at him. Then it sat down in the chair and looked at him some more. 10. Turl knew leverage when he saw it. As a veteran security officer, he depended on leverage at every turn. And advantage, and blackmail, a method of forcing compliance. And now it was turned around. This man-thing had sensed that it had leverage. He sat there studying the man-thing. Did it have any inkling of the plans? No, of course not. Possibly he had been too insistent, day after day, so that this thing sensed he wanted something of it. Possibly he had been too indulgent. He had gone to the trouble every day or two to go out and shoot rats for it. And earlier, hadn't he gotten it water? And look at all the cunning and difficulty of establishing what it ate. Here it stood, brave and strong, telling him it didn't eat that. Turl looked at it more closely. Well, not brave and strong. It looked pretty sickly, really. It had a worn robe around it, and yet it was almost blue with the coldness of the day. He glanced over at the pond. It was frozen over, dirt and all. He looked around further. The cage wasn't as dirty as it might have been. The thing evidently buried its jobs.
"Animal," said Turl, "you had better get to work if you know what is good for you."
Bluster sometimes made it even when one didn't have leverage. "The winter weather," said Johnny in Cyclo, "is bad for the machine. At night, and in rain or snow, I keep it covered with a deer hide from my pack. But the dampness is not good for it. It is becoming tarnished." Turl almost laughed. It was so funny to hear this animal actually speaking Cyclo. True, there was some accent, probably Chinko. No, maybe not Chinko, since all the polite phrases, the forgive me's and pardon me's Turl had heard when he checked the records, were not there. Turl had never met a Chinko since they were all dead, but he had met a lot of subject races on other planets, and they were carefully servile in their speech, as they should be.
"Animal," said Turl, "you may know the words, but you do not understand a proper attitude. Shall I demonstrate?"
Johnny could have been launched on a flight to the bars with one sweep of those huge paws. He drew himself up. "My name is not Animal. It is Johnny Goodboy Tyler." Turl absolutely gaped at him. The effrontery, the bald gall of this thing. He hit him. The collar almost broke Johnny's neck as the rope brought him up short. Turl stalked out of the cage and slammed the door. The ground shook like an earthquake as he stamped away. He had almost reached the outer door of the compound when he stopped. He stood there, thinking. Turl looked at the gray-white world, felt the cold glass of his face mask cutting his gaze. Blast this stinking planet. He turned around and walked back to the cage. He opened the door and went over to the man-thing. He picked it up, wiped the blood off its neck with a handful of snow, and then put it standing in front of the table.
"My name," said Turl, "is Turl. Now, what were we talking about?"
He knew leverage when he saw it. But never in their association thereafter did he ever address Johnny as anything other than Animal. A Cyclo, after all, could not ignore the fact that his was the dominant race, the greatest race in all universes. And this man thing, ugh.
Chapter 3 1
Zit was banging around in the transport repair shop, throwing down tools, discarding parts, and generally making an agitated din. He caught sight of Turl standing nearby, and he turned on him in an instant attack.
"Are you at the bottom of this pay cut?" demanded Zit.
Mildly, Turl said,
"That would be the accounting department, wouldn't it?"
"Why has my pay been cut?"
"It's not just your pay. It's also mine and everybody else's," said Turl.
"I've got 3 times the work, no help, and now half the pay."
"The planet is running at a loss, I'm told,"
said Turl.
"And no bonuses," said Zit.
Turl frowned. This was not the time or place for a favor.
Leverage. He had no leverage at all these days. "Been a lot of machines blowing up lately," said Turl.
Zit stood and looked at him. There was more than a hint of threat in that. One never knew about this Turl.
"What do you want?" said Zit. "I'm working on a project that could solve all this," said Turl, "that could get our pay and bonuses back."
Zit ignored that. When a security chief sounded like he was doing favors, watch it.
"What do you want?" said Zit. "If it's successful, we'd even get more pay and bonuses."
"Look, I'm busy. You see these wrecks?"
"I want the loan of a small mine car puller," said Turl.
Zit barked a sharp, sarcastic laugh.
"There's one. Blew up yesterday down at the transshipment area.
Take that.
The small bladed vehicle had its whole canopy blown off, and the green bloodstains had dried on its panel. Its interior wiring was charred.
What I want is a small pulling truck, said Turl. A simple one.
Zut went back to throwing tools and parts around. A couple narrowly missed Turl.
Well,
you got a requisition? Said Zut.
Well, began Turl.
I thought so, said Zut.
He stopped and looked at Turl.
You sure you haven't got anything to do with this pay cut?
Why?
Rumor around you were talking to the planet head.
Routine security.
Ha!
Zut attacked the wrecked, bladed vehicle with a hammer to remove the remains of its pressure canopy. Turl walked away.
Leverage. He had no leverage.
In deep gloom, he stood in a hallway between domes, lost in thought. He did have a solution of sorts, and there were signs of unrest. He made a sudden decision. A compound intercom was near to hand. He took hold of it and called Numpf.
Turl here, your planet ship. Could I have an appointment in about an hour? I have something to show you. Thank you, your planet ship. 1 hour.
He hung up, pulled his face mask off a belt hook, donned it, and went outside. Soft snowflakes were drifting down. At the cage, he went straight over to the far end of the flexi rope and untied it. Johnny had been working at the instruction machine, and he watched Turl warily. Turl, coiling up the rope, did not fail to notice that the man-thing was now using the chair to sit in. A bit arrogant, but it was good news, really. The thing had one of its hides rigged to the bars to keep snow off a sleeping place. There was another one tented over the machine and workplace. Turl yanked at the rope.
Come along,
he said.
You promised I could build a fire. Are we going out to get firewood? Asked Johnny.
Turl yanked on the rope and forced Johnny to follow him. He went straight to the old Chinko offices and booted open the door. Johnny looked around the place with interest. They were not inside the domes. This was an air-filled place. Dust lay in a blanket and stirred as they walked through the interior. There were papers scattered about, even books. There were charts on the walls. Johnny saw that this was where the desk and chair had come from, for many just like them stood about. Turl opened a locker and brought out a face mask and bottle. He hauled Johnny close to him and slammed the mask over his face. Johnny batted it off. It was quite large. It was also full of dust. Johnny found a rag in the locker and wiped the mask out. He examined the fastenings and discovered they were adjustable. Turl was rummaging around and finally came up with a small pump. He put a fresh power cartridge in the pump, connected it to the bottle, and began filling it with air.
What is this?
Asked Johnny.
Shut up, animal.
If it is supposed to work like yours, why do you have different bottles? Turl kept on pumping up the air bottle. Johnny threw down the mask and sat down against the locker door, looking the other way. The amber eyes slitted.
More mutiny, thought Turl. Leverage, leverage. He didn't have any.
All right, said Turl, disgusted. That is a Chinko air mask. Chinko's breathed air. You breathe air. You have to put it on to go in the compound or you'll die. My bottles contain proper breathe gas, and the compound domes are filled with breathe gas, not air. Now, satisfied?
You can't breathe air, said Johnny.
Turl controlled himself.
You can't breathe gas. Cyclos come from a proper planet that has proper breathe gas. You, animal, would die there. Put on that Chinko mask.
Did the Chinkos have to wear these in the compound?
I thought I told you.
Where are the Chinkos?
Were, said Turl,
thinking he was correcting the thing's grammar. It already spoke with an accent. High and squeaky, too. Not a proper bass. Irritating. They're not here anymore? Turl was about to tell him to shut up when a streak of sadism took over.
No, they're not here anymore. The Chinkos are dead, the whole race of them. And you know why?